Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Hawaiian Legacy Reforestation Initiative.
$16 million men served in World War II. Of that number, less than 1 million are alive today. And by 2025, they'll all be passed along. This show is in remembrance of Veterans Day. Please join me as we visit with Vera McGill, the chairperson for Honor Flight of Central Coast, California, an organization that brings World War II veterans back to Washington, D.C. to view the World War II Memorial and other military sites. And then we'll visit with an old friend of mine, Stephen Pivarski, who served for 4 years aboard the USS Idaho in World War II and was there in Tokyo Bay at the surrender. And like almost all the veterans, returned home and rejoined the civilian workforce and never talked about his war experience, hardly ever. It took more than a half a year of friendship to get Stephen to open up, and he shared openly his wartime experiences. And less than 5 months after I interviewed Stephen, he passed along, a mere 5 days before his 90th birthday. And then we'll visit with Hilary Kaiser, who spent most of the last 30 years in Paris. Hilary is the author of French War Brides, and she shares passionate stories about the young French women who married GIs and subsequently after the war emigrated to America to resettle with their new husbands. I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from the waterfront in Morro Bay, California. Right now we're with Bear McGill, who's the chairperson of Honor Flight, Central Coast, California. What is Honor Flight?
Honor Flight honors the men and women of World War II, and it will be going into the Korean War veterans and eventually into the Vietnam veterans to honor them for their service and to take them back to Washington, D.C. to tour the memorials that were built in their honor, especially with the World War II guys. The World War II memorial wasn't completed until 2004. It was the last memorial built in Washington, D.C.
Isn't that an incredible disconnect?
Unbelievable when I found out that it was the last memorial built. So there's a lot of these men and women who've never had the opportunity to see their memorial. Mm-hmm. And so what we do is we go out and raise money, and we find veterans, and we take them back to Washington so they can see their memorial.
As you know, by pure happenstance, last night I was with you on board the Honor Flight coming back from Washington, D.C., and it was, gosh, three-quarters of the flight were vets, and primarily World War II vets, and as far as I understand, all that live on the Central Coast?
Yes, we had 19 World War II veterans and ended up having two Korean veterans on this flight. And we're taking veterans right now from Salinas all the way down through Ventura, Oxnard, the Camarillo area. There are no hubs in those areas, so we're picking up anyone that we can find to get them back there, because this is very important to get them there to see their memorial.
How did Honor Flight start? It's nationwide, and there are different chapters or hubs all around America.
Well, Honor Flight started back in 2005. There's a gentleman back in Ohio that was a physician assistant working with some World War II guys. And when the World War II memorial was completed, he had asked the veterans if they'd ever been to see their memorial, and none of them had.
Wow.
So he rounded up six pilots, and they flew some veterans on their own planes.
Private airplanes.
Wow. And flew them back there and toured their memorial. And after they toured, they saw a huge change in these veterans. Because, as you know, a lot of World War II veterans don't talk about what happened during World War II.
Well, I mean,
these
were
kids.
Yeah.
And so there was another gentleman in Ohio that heard about what these guys had done and got together with them, and that's how Honor Flight got started.
Mm-hmm. Let's dovetail back to the Central Coast chapter here. Again, when did it start?
We got our Hub chapter in November of 2013. Prior to that, my son, who's a fireman over in Kern County, was 23 at the time, went on his first flight as a guardian with Honor Flight Kern County.
And explain the guardian. That's a real nice, touching adjunct to the program.
Every veteran that goes has a guardian that goes with them to make sure that they see everything that they want to see and take care of the veteran to make sure that, you know, they don't trip or something like that. Mm-hmm. Or if they need assistance, they're there to assist the veteran. We've had gentlemen in wheelchairs, and so it's their job as a guardian to make sure they get their breakfast and dinner and everything served to them. And every guardian that goes, they pay $1,200 to go.
For their flight and for their room and board.
Yes, it covers the whole trip. We tell guys the only money you need to bring is if you want to buy some type of souvenir back there. Otherwise, everything's paid for.
For the vets, everything is covered?
Yeah, the vets pay nothing. Mm-hmm. You know, they wrote their check years ago, right. 70 years ago, and so that's why we go out and fundraise.
And how do you fundraise? How do you get the word out?
Well, right now it's just kind of word of mouth. We're looking for more people to come in and join our board and come up with other fundraising ideas. I'm looking at trying to put together some type of dinner where we have, you know, we invite these World War II veterans to come down and have the public come down and just listen to these guys, because, I mean, this is live history.
I know, and it's fragile, and it's not going to be here that long.
No, we have less than a million World War II veterans left, and I've been told that by 2025 we'll have zero World War II veterans in this country. I had one veteran that was supposed to go on this trip who passed away on us 3 weeks ago, and so we took a picture of him, and we honored him in spirit at the World War II Memorial while we was back there.
The honor flight that I was aboard with you, what was the youngest vet that you had?
The youngest vet we had, I think, was 84, and the oldest vet we had was 94. I've been on flights with a gentleman that was 101,
wow.
And I thought he was 90.
Wow.
Yeah, he's amazing, amazing.
The lives that they lived by the time they were 20 or 21, and then lived with it and have lived with it forever.
Yeah, one of the vets that I had on this trip, he was actually a clerk for General Eisenhower, and he told me that he got to take Hitler's yacht up the Rhine.
Wow, that's a memorable cruise.
Yeah, I guess he said that once they took over Germany and Hitler was dead, that Hitler didn't need his yacht anymore. So,
tell us about some of the other touching people that you met on this honor flight and their stories.
You know, there's so many of them. I've been on four flights. There was one story that really sticks with me. There's two gentlemen sitting at dinner. One gentleman was sitting there talking about being in Bastogne, how they were surrounded by the Germans. And as he's sitting there talking, a guy across from him, he speaks up and says that he was in, and I wish I could remember the company, but he says he was in this company, and the guy across just starts bawling.
Wow.
And looks at the guy and says, "You guys saved my life." And so they start talking, and the one gentleman asks, "So where were you at in Bastogne?" And he starts explaining where he was at in Bastogne. I mean, down to the
intersection.
And the other vet across the table looks at him. He says, "I was behind that wall. They were at the same spot during that battle, and didn't know each other until 70 years later when they went on this honor flight together." And they both started crying, and today they're still best friends now.
Yeah, you're making me cry.
Every time I take one of these trips, I get tears in my eyes to see the public, how they are welcoming these guys. And, you know, it's long overdue for these guys, because when they came back from the war, less than 2% of them had any type of homecoming. And these gentlemen are just very touched by all the people that come up to them. You know, they were kids when they went to war. Mm-hmm. I had one gentleman that was 15 when he went in, and he spent his 16th, 17th, 18th birthday fighting in the South Pacific. And, you know, they all came home, no fanfare. They went right back to work or to school, and they built this great country for us. And so, you know, everybody needs to realize that when you see a World War II veteran out there, you need to go thank them for what they did for us, because had they not gone and did what they did, we may not be here today, or we might be speaking Japanese or German. And yeah. So these are just, that's why Tom Brokaw calls them the greatest generation.
I was just going to say, that's such a truism. It's humblingly true.
Yes, and, you know, a lot of these guys, you know, we've talked to family members, and they just don't talk about what they did in World War II. It was really, a lot of them say, you know, we just went and did what we had to do. Mm-hmm. And they don't think they're heroes. They always say, no, we left the heroes over there, which we left a little over 400,000 men and women over there in World War II. But I always tell them, no, you guys are heroes, and you will always be heroes in my eyes.
See if you can think of another touching story.
You know, my first flight that I went on, the veteran that I had, I'm walking around the World War II memorial. We're on the Atlantic side of the memorial, and he starts pointing out all the battles that he was there in. And he gets to this one battle, and he says, that's where I got my two Purple Hearts. And I looked at him, I said, how do you get two Purple Hearts in one day? And he says, well, we're crossing the river in these boats. He says, I get blown out of the boat. And he says, next thing I know, I'm being shipped off in a ambulance. As I'm being shipped off in an ambulance, the Germans blew up the ambulance and killed everybody in the ambulance except me. And,
wow.
And that's how he got his two Purple Hearts in one day.
Wow.
And, I mean, it's stories like that that you just don't know and just are amazing. And the same veteran told me that when he was in Africa, they were lined up on the runway with the Tuskegee Airmen. And he said, you know, the Tuskegee Airmen, they're giving them a bunch of just know-nothing missions. He tells me, he says, you know, there's nothing cold in Africa. He says, we would get our 2% beer, and we got to know these gentlemen, and they would take our beer up in their planes and fly around and bring it down. We'd have some cold beer, and we'd share it with them. And I'm like, wow, that's just an amazing story. That's one that you'll never see in the history books,
yeah.
You know? And then I asked him about the Jeeps, because you always see in the movies how guys would steal Jeeps, and I had guys tell me, oh, yeah, we'd be in the bars, and we'd see some captain or something come up in their Jeep, and, you know, we need to get back to base, so we would we'd jump in their Jeep and take off with them, and then we'd get back and we'd change numbers on them. It's like, holy mackerel.
Before we go, any more touching memories of your interface with Honor Flight?
There's just a lot of them. I mean, you know, when we take these gentlemen to Arlington Cemetery and see the changing of the guard at the Tomb of the Unknown, I mean, you have guys that are in wheelchairs, and when they start to play taps, you know, these gentlemen want to get up and stand and salute, and it's just, it brings tears to my eyes every time I see that.
For further information about Honor Flight, Central Coast, California.
We do have a website. It's honorflightccc.org. If you'd like to see photos from our trips, we have a Facebook page. It's Honor Flight, Central Coast of California. If anybody would like to get in touch with and find out more about Honor Flight, feel free to give me a call. My number is 805-610-4012. I'd love to talk to you.
Barry McGill, Chairperson, Honor Flight, Central Coast, California. My honor to meet you.
It's my honor. Thank you, sir. And, you know, we owe it to these men and women. They've done so much for us that this is just a little bit that we can give back to them.
Thank you so much.
I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Morro Bay, California.
Members of the Senate, of the House of Representatives, yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, the United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
The Japanese surprise attack on Pearl Harbor, December 7, 1941. It's a date that, as President Roosevelt noted, will forever live in infamy. It is a date that forever changed the lives of every American living at that time. Eventually, more than 16 million served in the United States military during World War II. By the end of the war, more than 273,000 soldiers from the Army, Navy, and Marines were killed in action, with another 4,946 subsequently dying of their wounds received in battle. In the United States Navy alone, there were more than 96,000 casualties. Most of the soldiers who served their country went on to establish successful careers after the war, and most did their best to leave their memories tucked safely away, and when asked about their combat experiences, they most often refused to dredge up and talk about their time in combat. A friend of mine, 90-year-old Stanley Steve Pivarsky, joined the United States Navy shortly after the attack on Pearl Harbor, and he remained shipboard, manning the 14-inch guns until the Japanese surrender in the harbor of Tokyo aboard the USS Missouri. Stephen was there, mere yards away at his battle station aboard the battleship USS Idaho. I'm Tom Wilmer. Come along and join me as we visit with Stanley Steve Pivarsky at his home in Morro Bay, California.
My name is Stanley Pivarsky, and I live here at 515 Yerba Buena Street in Morro Bay.
Steve, when were you born?
I was born May 8, 1922, Chicago, Illinois.
When you got out of high school, what were you doing?
I was looking for jobs because the way we were brought up, that whenever you finished high school or whatever, if you couldn't go to college, you had to help with the family problems. Mm-hmm. So that's my first job I had to do. I had to donate so much to my folks. My folks didn't want any amount. They just said, you give what you can. Mm-hmm. And that's what I did.
What did you do for work?
Well, I worked at one of the American Mazo places. It made cornstarch and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And then my last job, my big job, was with working with Edison Company. And I was a mechanic. I worked 36 years for them and just had a great retirement. And I'm really enjoying it.
Hey, here's a little of that boogie beat. Extra special because it's Boogie Woogie.
Let's go back in time for a moment. The date is December 6, 1941. What were you doing? That was a Saturday.
Well, a Saturday, I think I was still at home.
When you woke up on December 7th, what happened?
Well, nothing really happened until my brother took me to a Chicago Bears football team in Soldiers Field, and it was announced there that Pearl Harbor had been bombed. You could have dropped a pin in that stadium, and that's where it all started.
What did you think?
Oh, it was awful. God, you just hardly could, you know, you could hardly think about what was going to happen next, what you were going to have to do, you know, if you're going to have to go to war, and so that's just the way it was. Mm-hmm.
When you went home, did you turn the radio on and and what information did you learn when you went home and listened to the radio?
Well, the fact that, you know, the Japanese had that sneak bomb attack on Pearl Harbor.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special bulletin from Washington, D.C. At 7:55 this morning, the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor from the air and all naval and military activities on the island of Oahu. Principal American base in the Hawaiian Islands, this is not a joke, this is the real McCoy. Oahu was attacked at 7:55 this morning by Japanese planes. The rising sun emblem of Japan was seen on the plane wingtips. Wave after wave of bombers streamed through the clouded sky from the southwest and flung their missiles on a city resting in peaceful Sabbath calm. According to an unconfirmed report received at the Hawaiian governor's office, the Japanese force that attacked Oahu reached island waters aboard two small airplane carriers. It was also reported that either an attempt had been made to bomb the USS Lexington or that it had been bombed. So far, six people are known dead, 21 injured at emergency hospitals. We will bring you more updates as we receive them. Now back to our regular programming.
But anyway, that's the way it went. And then I was called up.
So when you went through basic, was it at Great Lakes Naval Training?
Yeah. It was Great Lakes.
Eventually, you went aboard a battleship, and that was the USS Idaho. Did you know you were going to go shipboard?
I tried to get into the submarine area, but I couldn't handle that because I suffer from claustrophobia. And when I got to thinking about that, I figured, nah. So eventually, they just signed me up to, you know, to go aboard ship. And that's where it all started.
What date when you went aboard the Idaho?
1942. And then it was just a matter of doing things, and then eventually I took an exam for gunner's mate, and I passed it, and then I was aboard the Idaho with 14-inch gun turrets. There was two forward and two aft. And then we went back into Seattle for more repairs. It was just an experience.
When you steamed out of the Puget Sound, did you know where you were going?
No. No, they don't revolve that until you're out so many miles at sea.
Did you have a sense, an instinct of where you might be going?
Well, not really, because you're new. You know, you're young. I was 19 years old, and you know, you just think and you just take one day at a time.
So where did you wind up going? Where was your first battle?
Well, we were in eight landing invasions. See, what we did, we would cruise the island, bombard the island for maybe an hour or so. And then when the landing crews finally started, they would land and do whatever they could do. And if there was any kind of a position where they needed a gun mount or something knocked off, they would contact the ships and we would do that.
And the islands that you can remember?
My memory doesn't, like I say, eight battle engagements, and we shot down nine planes. And it was just the Idaho started out, was coming back from Iceland. We started from Pearl Harbor. We went to... Okinawa was our last one. We went to Saipan, Utah, Peleliu, the Manus Islands, Marshall Islands, Ifadi, and Marion Islands.
The Marianas?
Yeah, Marianas. And then we finally ended up in Iwo Jima, Okinawa. That's where we finished.
But you also were up by Attu in Alaska, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, we patrolled there for quite a while. And actually, it was quite a battle at Attu. Now, Kiska, there wasn't anybody there. There wasn't a Japanese there. Anyway, we took that and then just went from there.
Now, at one point, the Idaho was hit by a Japanese kamikaze plane.
Yes.
You remember that day well.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, we were aboard. We were at general quarters, and we were at, you know, the ready firing position when that bomb dropped, and it really shook the ship.
And it hit one of the blisters?
One of the blisters. That was quite a jolt. We didn't know right from then what had happened, and then it was passed over the... PA by the gunnery officer up above the turrets.
And you were in the 14-inch turret at that time, so you didn't really have any idea what was going on at all.
No, we didn't know.
Did you hear the explosion?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. It rocked the ship.
Did you ever feel that you were at risk for Mayday and abandoned ship, or did you?
Those thoughts enter your mind, sure. Mm-hmm. And it was just, you know, it was a kind of a worrisome thing, but you did what you had to do, and... Mm-hmm. You know, the gunnery officer, he tried to, you know, calm us guys. And so that was, you know, that was the way that went.
You and I had a discussion one time about heroes in the war. And you said, you know, I wasn't a hero, I just did my job. But you made me think right now, a true hero on board a naval ship are the firemen. They are incredible.
Absolutely. They are ready to go at a minute's notice.
And no fear. They will jump right in, and they know their life is imminently at risk.
Absolutely. Some make it. There's others that don't. And it was just a worrisome, terrible thing.
Yeah. Did you have many casualties on board the Idaho?
There were several. We had two Kingfisher observation planes. They were shot down. As far as the casualties aboard ship, I don't think we had any. We had a couple of, you know, fake burials for the pilots. No, as far as the gunnery sites above the turrets, they all were handled pretty good. They survived pretty good.
At that time in the Navy, it was a segregated Navy. Talk to us about that experience.
Well, we got along pretty good. There was a little bit of, you know, of scary times, but...
How so?
Well, after, you know, it was just the fact that, you know, at that particular time, you know, we weren't very much educated as to what was going on with blacks, whites, pinks, and purples, you know. And you learn to get along because you're all aboard the same ship and you try to watch each other's back. And that's what we did. And we got along fine.
What other ways do you think that you grew and learned things not directly military related?
Well, it's just the fact that when you're in a war like that, you don't know from time to time whether you're going to make it or not, you know? And it's just one of those things that you carry with you. And I was homesick an awful lot, but eventually I got over that because it was just a matter of time, you know? And being aboard ship 3 years, why, eventually you learn how to get along with things. And everything went fine, really.
So you stayed shipboard through the surrender of the Japanese?
Yeah, I was discharged December 20th, 1945.
When the surrender was signed aboard the Missouri,
right.
Where were you?
We were there. We were in Sagami Bay waiting for the surrender, and it was also we were at general quarters, and the word was passed that all gun emplacements were to be tagged with a white flag. And that next morning when we looked through our tour portholes, that whole island turned white. If we had invaded Japan, it would have lasted at least another 2 to 3 years. They were ready.
Let's back up a moment in time. Let's go back to April, May 1945. At that moment in time, nobody knew about the atomic bomb. The common thought was we were imminently ready to invade Japan.
Absolutely.
You and I talked about Ulithi Atoll and that being a staging ground. Did you ever go out to Ulithi?
Yes, we did.
And there were, at one point, 1,000 naval ships
absolutely.
There. When you were there, how many ships were in Ulithi?
The ocean was just full of ships, all kinds, you name it, battleships to destroyers to all kinds.
What did you think at that moment in time? You knew you were getting ready to physically invade Japan.
Absolutely. It was scary. It was a scary moment. We weren't told, but we knew from experience and what was going on that this was going to be the next big move. And then, of course, you know, the bombing of the dropping of the A-bomb, and that changed a whole lot. The bomb was horrible. It was just horrible. But if it hadn't been for that, we would have been in a war.
So after August 1945, what were you doing and where were you?
Let's see. At that time, I think we went back to the training base, and from there is where I was discharged.
And that was where?
Great Lakes.
When you were discharged, what rank were you?
Gunner's Mate, third class. I went for second class, but I didn't pass. And I was okay. And I figured, well, that's, you know, I did my time, and I just won it out.
So now it is December 1945. You're discharged, yeah. And you went home?
Yes, I went home, and I was glad to be home, and so were my folks. And it was just a great feeling. That was it.
When you went home, were there any parades or any welcome home? You just kind of brought your duffel bag back and walked into the house.
Walked into the house. My folks were just so glad to see me, and home I was.
Since you were discharged and you got on with your life, how often do you remember the war or think back to days, a specific incident, a specific moment?
Well, the best thing I can say there, which I try to tell everybody, is the fact that I didn't like to talk about the war.
You still don't like to talk about the war. It was hard to get you to sit down today.
Even today. And I tell people that, you know, and they understand it.
Why?
Well, it was just the fact that there was so many casualties, so many deaths that were going on. And, it bothered me, even at that young age. I thought about it an awful lot. And when people ask me how I felt about the war, I said, please, I just don't care to talk about it. And that's the way that went.
And it's still going that way, isn't it?
It's still going that way.
And right now you're 90 years old, and it was a long time ago, but obviously it is still so fresh in your mind.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It's painfully
fresh. I
dream
about it sometimes.
Do you?
Absolutely. It was just one of those things that you just thought. It was quite an experience. We just took one day at a time.
Any other thoughts about your time in the Navy?
Well, you know, just the fact that I did it, and I don't know what would have happened if I'd have been in the Army. Whether I made it or not, I'm just glad to be out. Just glad to be out.
Stephen Pivarsky, thank you so much. What a joy and a pleasure to visit with you.
Oh, it was great, Tom.
You're my hero.
Well, thank you.
The best generation.
Okay, you betcha.
I'm Tom Wilmer. We've been speaking with Stephen Pivarsky. A postscript. The day after I interviewed Stephen Stanley Pivarsky, his daughter Annie came up to me and asked, Steve did tell you about his silver and 2 bronze stars that he was awarded, didn't he? And I said, no, of course not. And it seems so fitting that Stephen conveniently forgot to mention that.
Dr. Hilary Kaiser is a history buff and an oral historian who knows how to use interviews to tell a good story and give a new perspective on the French-American experience. A dual American-French national, she is a graduate of San Francisco State University and the Sorbonne, where she earned her Ph.D., and where she held a position as a tenured associate professor of American culture and intercultural communication. Kaiser has appeared on French radio and television shows and been interviewed in the French press, and has lectured on her research in both France and the United States. An engaging speaker and presenter, she currently divides her time between Paris and San Francisco. Working as a freelance storyteller and an intercultural trainer, Kaiser is the author of French War Brides in America, Veteran Recall, Americans in France Remember the War, and World War II Voices, American GIs and the French Women Who Married Them. I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer. Come along and join me in San Francisco for a chat with Dr. Hilary Kaiser. Hi, Hilary.
Hi, Tom.
So I'm so curious about you and your life. It seems weeks ago we were emailing each other from France to here, and here you are now in San Francisco. Tell us about what you've been up to.
Well, I grew up in San Francisco. I was born in New York, and when I was 3, my parents moved west, and I lived here till I was 15 when my dad got a job in Paris working for the Department of Commerce, and we moved to Paris when I was a teenager, and I graduated from the American School of Paris, then I went to college in the States, college in Ireland, and I ended up in France and was going back to, on my way back to San Francisco, and met a Frenchman on the ship, and he was going to be a graduate student at Caltech. We dated for a year, and then he brought me back to France, and then we got married, and so I lived for 30 years with a French husband and had 3 French-American sons, and had a career teaching.
Today, what do you do when you go back to France each year?
I started living part of the year here in San Francisco and part of the year in Paris because my children and grandchildren are back there.
Tell us about your writing world and the books you've been writing. This is fascinating.
All right. Well, I got very interested in oral history. So back in 1993, I started interviewing U.S. veterans of World War II who had retired in France, believe it or not, and who had French wives. The first book that I did was concentrated more on the war stories of the vets, and then I realized that some of these wives had stories of their own, so I interviewed some of those wives, and then I did a second book where I went on a much larger basis and interviewed French war brides all over America.
So there must be some common denominator, something that's brought to the table by that cross-the-pond marriage and cross-cultural melding of different backgrounds.
Yes, I think there's a mutual attraction. I mean, many Americans think that the French don't like Americans, but they do, and they love American culture. And you have to remember wartime. A lot of these French women had gone through really trying circumstances during the war under the German occupation and had been teenagers, and they saw these American GIs who were fresh and big and, you know, the liberators who came over. And so that created big romances. Not only were they tall, the Americans, you have to remember that even before the war, the American movies were very popular, American jazz was very popular, American novels. And so a lot of these French women were living what they thought was going to be the American dream. It didn't always work out as well as they hoped, but it was the American dream.
Tell us a bit more. How does your current book that you have out, for example, tell us how it unfolds?
Right. Well, the current book I have out exists as an e-book and then a paperback of the e-book. It's a collection of some of the interviews that I did back in 1993, and very sadly, of the 17 interviews that were first published back in 1994, I would say more than half of those veterans have passed away. And so for me, it was getting stories out there for younger people, because I think the present generation forgets about World War II. And I wanted to tell their stories, their war stories. And then I combined that with some of the war bride stories and then a paper that I gave at the Peace Memorial Museum in Caen in Normandy, which is something we don't always think about. I gave a paper at this conference about the effect that the Allied bombings had on Normandy and how people lost a lot of things that the French loved, the liberators, etc. But this conference was showing that how the people of Normandy really did suffer a lot from both the German bombings and the American and British bombings as well.
And that's something that an American can't even comprehend of in their imagination.
That's true. And if you think about a city like Le Havre, or Caen. I mean, they were completely destroyed because the Allies were trying to chase out the Germans that were still left there. So these towns, if you go to them today, are not terribly picturesque at all. They're very modern. They were rebuilt very rapidly back in the late 40s and 50s. And so, you know, we have to remember that. French did suffer a lot throughout the war.
In addition to the suffering and the loss, there is that admiration and reverence for the American GIs who were truly their liberators, and that has never gone away in France. Tell us about how that reverence lives on today, Normandy and along the coast, for example.
Oh, yes, definitely. I mean, there are celebrations, of course, for D-Day every year. They're on Veterans Day. I know some of these gentlemen who are members of the American Legion in Paris and also the Veterans of Foreign Wars, and they're always out there on Memorial Day laying wreaths and participating with their French allies. And then you go to Normandy and they, especially for around June, in June 6th, there are all sorts of flags, American flags, there are all sorts of celebrations. No, it does live on, definitely.
The generation that can consciously remember D-Day, for example, like you alluded to earlier, they're dying off at a rapid rate. Has that reverence been passed along to the younger generation, or is it something that's going to go away?
I think it has been passed on to the younger generation. They have heard about it, definitely. But it's probably the same here. World War II, you know, there have been other wars since then now. You know, Vietnamese War, different wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I think you see it much more in Europe, probably, than you see it over here with World War II.
And talking to you earlier, you mentioned that some of your research in oral history for your books, etc., dealt with World War I, going that far back.
Right. What I discovered was that there were as many French war brides who married American soldiers after World War I as after World War II. So I did quite a lot of research on that and how the GIs met, because there was a policy with the U.S. Army of no fraternization with French women. But, of course, there was. And I did quite a lot of research on that. And then unfortunately, the one French war bride for World War I that I was supposed to interview passed away a week before our interview. But I did have the opportunity of interviewing three daughters of World War I war brides. And as I said, I did quite a lot of archival research on the subject. And, World War I is still quite evident in Europe and throughout Germany and France and England, etc.
Some of your most touching anecdotal moments that you heard or experienced talking to these women.
One of them is about a woman called Marcelle, who was a very coquettish, flirtatious little French lady who was from Paris. And she met her husband, as many of them did, at a street dance. And he was very tall, very elegant in his uniform. As I said, she was from Paris. She was rather sophisticated, even though she wasn't terribly educated, but she was very sophisticated, as Parisians often are. And he said, well, I want you to marry me. And he did take her back, but he went on ahead of her. She went over, as many of the war brides did, on the troop transport, had to begin at Camp Philip Morris in Normandy, where they were processed, and they got orientation, went over on the ship, arrived in New York City, were taken by the American Red Cross volunteers down to the train, and then went out to Alabama. And she arrived at the station of Alabama, which was a town called Gordo, in the middle of nowhere. And the station consisted of just a wooden hut. And there she saw this cowboy with a hat. And she couldn't recognize him at all. She said, where is my handsome GI in his uniform? And it turned out that he and his parents had a farm, and she had to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and milk the cows. Everyone around her was chewing tobacco. She was very good about it, and she really was very fond of her in-laws, but it was a very hard life for her. And then the husband, unfortunately, as often happened, is something we talk about now after the Vietnamese War and after Afghanistan and Iraq, is the husband is suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder and was an alcoholic and was a womanizer. And he left the farm, bought a truck, and became a truck driver and was never seen again.
Oh, my God. Not a happy ending.
Not a happy. They're not all like that. I have a wonderful story, too, if you'd like to hear it. A woman from Marseille, who was a Jewish lady who had all sorts of troubles during the war, had been hidden with her father had lost his job because he was Jewish at the university. In any case, she survived the war, and just after the war in France had been liberated while the war was still going on in Germany, she went one day to give her blood. There was an American Army blood-giving dispensary. She went in there, and this young male nurse who took her blood took a liking to her and came over to the house, and they started dating. He turned out to be a Bible-carrying Protestant from Arkansas. He finally had to go back to the war in Germany. He asked for her hand. The Jewish father said, "No, you're homesick. Wait a year and come back. And if you still love her, come back and get her." And he did come back and get her. He became a doctor, and she became the doctor's wife. She went on and became a French teacher. And she, unfortunately, I just heard she passed away about 3 months ago. Yeah.
Hillary Kaiser, before we go, tell us how the listener could find out more about you, your website, and how they might order one of your books.
Oh, how nice. My website is www.hillary-kaiser.com. Would love people to share the stories of these very interesting people.
Excellent. We've been speaking with author and writer and world traveler and part-time Parisian, Hillary Kaiser. I'm Tom Wilmer.
Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Hawaiian Legacy Reforestation Initiative.
Hawaiian Legacy Hardwoods and Four Seasons Resort Maui at Wailea invite you to sponsor a legacy tree and contribute to the biodiversity of Hawaii. Legacy trees can honor an individual, commemorate an event, or memorialize a loved one. Every tree dedication is a living legacy and a gift which grows grander year after year. The best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago. The second best time is now.
The Hawaiian Legacy Reforestation Initiative was awarded the 2014 EcoTour Operator of the Year by the Hawaiian Ecotourism Association. To learn more, visit legacytrees.org or call 1-877-707-TREE.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show, Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a weekly featured podcast on NPR.org, produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. Our San Francisco-based associate producer is Molly Blaisdell, covering the San Francisco Bay Area, the island of Maui, and the South Pacific. Our Wisconsin-based associate producer is Julie Henning, and Lauren Hayes is our technical assistant.
Oh.